Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. Sadly, this is the final episode of THC Audio, and we'd give you one to remember. Joining us today are two people who need no introduction, but we're going to introduce them anyway, Aaron Dolan and Sean Doolittle. How are you both doing today?
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thank you, guys.
There's been a lot of talk recently and in the past couple of years about team revenue and whether MLB does enough to draw in an audience. Do you think concerns about dwindling audiences are overblown, or is there a real concern about lack of viewership?
I can take this one. If I start mansplaining too much, please let me know and cut me off. But I think it is a concern. The low attendance figures are a concern. There's been some evidence of, like with TV viewership, that's fluctuated drastically within markets. But I think last year, for the most part, it was actually up, at least in prime time in the local markets. But I think one thing that's not getting talked about that is super important to note is that last year, for the 10 best teams in the league, if you looked at their attendance numbers, their attendance was up. Not a lot, because you know you're still looking at rising ticket prices. The cost to go to games is still really high. But the 10 best teams saw an attendance increase of about 2%. The bottom 20 teams, they saw a significant decrease in attendance. I think it was down maybe 17%. So I think what you're seeing is, and what that says is that even in the face of rising ticket prices, fans are still willing to go to games if the teams are putting a winning product on the field. I think, you know, this is all kind of tied together with a lot of the labor issues that we're talking about, that we're seeing, that, you know, players, especially fans, especially want to see their teams, you know, spending money and trying to compete. And it's almost kind of a field of dreams scenario, if you will, if the teams build
current system that we have. It's a little bit of an archaic system with the blackout restrictions in particular, and it can feel kind of arbitrary sometimes, or it can feel like sort of one of those things that's just, you know, needlessly penalizes certain markets. And that is, I think, absolutely true, because it's an old system. And a lot of the variables have changed. You know, the idea was that people, I believe, would, you know, either they were able to go to, they would, it would do, it was to incentivize people to attend games in their local market. And I think the thought was, well, if they're not attending games, then, well, they shouldn't be able to watch them, or that should be the best way, the first option. Mm-hmm. And with these cable deals, you're wondering how sustainable that might be moving forward, given how many people are watching on smartphones, how many people are cutting the cable, how many people are watching on their devices or on other, you know, apps. And that can be really frustrating for people. And you are starting, you know, to wonder if those cable deals, well, if that bubble will burst.
I think we just need to do it. We can do a better job in the game of making the game more accessible. In my interactions with fans on social media, as I've started to raise issues regarding some of the labor issues and the topics regarding kind of the business of baseball and how we're going to grow the game. I found it really, really interesting that none of the fans that I was interacting with were voicing concerns over the pace of play issues or issues regarding the shift or some of these new quote-unquote problems that we're seeing in the sport, rising strikeout numbers and, you know, the three true outcomes of strikeouts, walks, and home runs. Fans want more access to the game. They want to be able to consume it on their tablets and their laptops and their smartphones. They want to be able to take their families to games. I think this is something that's been lost in a lot of the talk about the, you know, kind of the state of baseball today.
So let's kind of dive right into the labor aspect of this. These conversations can get, one of our favorite topics here on the podcast. So these conversations often get linked to comments about team spending, with the idea being that teams can't afford large contracts or to pay players a lot of money. What do you think is the driving force behind this narrative, and how can it best be combated?
Oh man, I think there's a lot of driving forces behind this now. I think, you know, you're seeing teams that are starting to use this soft cap that we have, this luxury tax threshold that is essentially kind of acting like a soft cap, the way these teams are using it, and how they're more reluctant, I think, to go over it than we had initially thought they would be when we were looking at this in bargaining. And you know, it used to be that you had to put together a winning product on the field and have your team be really, really competitive in order to make money. So you kind of had to spend money to make money, so to speak. Now with these new revenue streams that we're seeing, you have, you know, these TV deals, the national TV deals from ESPN, Fox and Turner Sports, you know, the corporate ad sponsorships that are coming in now, all these new revenue streams that have opened up in Major League Baseball now mean that there's less of an incentive essentially for clubs to spend money on players than ever before, because they can make their money elsewhere. And you know, their argument is that, you know, they're running it like a business, and there's no longer any incentive for you to be a team that's just one of the competitors. So we're seeing a league where the teams are either one of the best teams in the league, or unfortunately, on the other end of the spectrum, there's not as much parity across the league now. So the question for us now becomes, the players and the union becomes, how do we incentivize ownership to spend money on these teams or on these free agents, on player contracts? Because there's more money in the game than ever before, right? We're seeing these record revenues being generated. Major League Baseball's media production arm, Baseball Advanced Media, just did a deal with Disney that's worth, you know, $2.5 billion. The league saw revenues of over $10 billion last year. Baseball is in a very, very healthy spot financially. And so now the questions start to be about how do we turn it back towards the players? How do we incentivize the owners to reinvest that money into the product, which is the players?
Right. And I think we hear that a lot. You touched on something I think that we hear a lot, in that people believe that it is a business. MLB is a business, and they are running it as such. And in, you know, our experience and everything tells us businesses, they want to maximize the profit. And that means when they have revenues, they may not want to invest it in labor. They may not, wages may not rise tracking with the increased revenue. And so when you see this happening and people are saying, well, it's a business, the owners, they own the teams, they're more than, you know, it's more than fair if they're able to pocket whatever they want. But it's not a business in the sense that other businesses are, because other businesses are not getting the same exemptions from certain things that, you know, MLB is allowed to get exemptions from, such as the minimum wage exemption, the antitrust exemption. They're in taxpayer-subsidized infrastructure like stadiums. And these are things that other businesses cumulatively do not get to benefit from. Some businesses do benefit from those sorts of programs and subsidies individually, but cumulatively, they are not benefiting anywhere near the way that Major League Baseball is able to benefit from those sorts of exemptions. And so on one hand, yes, technically it of course is a business, but it's not, if it's such a business, why aren't they able to turn a profit and run a business without those programs like every other business has to, you know? And so I think another thing Sean mentioned is the competitiveness, and the fielding a competitive team is just simply more watchable. And I think one of the things that can be done to increase competition and, I guess, watchability, if you want to call it that, is overhauling the postseason structure, the schedules, and the way that teams play each other, the number of times they play each other. And I think somebody last year even suggested a split season, similar to a minor league setup, where they have different winners. I don't totally understand.
You would split the season into halves, and so you know, you would have an 80-game season for the first half of the year, and you would have a group of playoff teams from that part of the season. So you would have maybe your three division wild card team, and then the season essentially completely resets for another 81 games, and you have another set of playoff teams. If the same team wins the division or the wild card position, it goes to the next best team in the standings for that half the year. And it's a little bit more of a drastic proposal, but the idea is that if your chance to make the playoffs is only something over a 3-month window, well, you have a better chance to make the playoffs. You can make a trade or two. You can spend money. If you can get hot for a month or two, you can find yourself in the playoffs. And then once you're in the playoffs, anything can happen. But I think all of these things are starting to come up, because what we're really trying to protect at the end of the day is the integrity of the game, right? The idea is that you're putting this team out on the field trying to win a World Series. And, you know, the long game, you know, it's just not that the long game that some of these teams are playing, it's just not, I don't know if it's good for the overall health of the sport in the bigger picture.
And attendance records are demonstrating that year after year, that these teams that are not fielding a competitive product, they're people aren't attending, and they're not watching on TV either. So what do? You have to increase competition. You have to increase something watchable. And these leagues, this would sort of combat how certain divisions, for example, last year we saw in the AL Central, I believe, I mean, one team is runaway, and then by 3 or 4 weeks in, four other teams are completely out of it by, what, May? Why would you want to go to those games unless the stadium experience is just so fantastic and you're just that much? It's just such a small niche market at that point that the casual fan that they're trying to retain, if not grow, it's just not going to appeal to them. If that makes sense.
Yeah, and like one of the things that I was also thinking of is how, like, even when ticket prices go down for the bottom 20 teams, like, no one really wants to go buy those cheap tickets unless they're like they really, really love the game, and then like you can afford these tickets, but no one's going to want to show up because they don't want to see a bottom 20 team.
Right. And I think there's something to be said for some of the programs that some teams have come up with. I think, I don't know how many teams, but I know the Nationals have this program. I know the Oakland A's used to, at least when you were there, they probably still do, where you can get sort of like a season pass or a monthly pass, and it's a little bit less expensive, but they give you sort of a seat that's chosen the day of the game or something, and you pay a flat rate, which is extremely affordable. And I've that's how I got my tickets for the last season Sean was with the A's. I know the Orioles, which I love and I think every team should do, the Orioles have made every child, I think it's under 9 years old, attend a game for free if they're attending with an adult who's paying full price. I think that is an incredible program. If you want to attract and retain young viewership, I don't know why every team's not doing this, because you're there, family, you know, I don't know, even if you don't care about growing the game, you just want to maximize profit in the stadium experience, and that's all you care about, if you're a family there for a game, you're going to, you know, you may be more likely to buy concessions or, you know, to spend money within the stadium. So I don't know why more teams aren't doing that. And I think it would be a great way, an easy way to grow viewership and fans.
Yeah, that's honestly kind of baffling because you see, like, I've seen my friends who have kids take their kids to games and all they want to do is eat and go to the store and buy stuff.
That's me. That's like kids. Like, adult, that's any, yeah, that's.
Yeah, so we're definitely at an interesting crossroads in certain ways with the game right now, and another different but nonetheless very modern baseball issue is the use of social media, which I know both of you are very active on Twitter. I know this is near and dear to your hearts. So, you know, we're not going to name any names here or anything, but we know that baseball players have not always been responsible with the platform that they have and have at times almost weaponized their platform against other users who don't have the same sort of leverage that they do. So how much discussion of social media usage happens in clubhouses?
I used to think the worst thing a baseball player could possibly tweet was like some like agent mandated sponsored T-Mobile tweet or something, you know, it's just boring content, but we found out that that is not the case. And that is not the worst thing that they could do on social media. But yeah, Sean, you probably, well, you definitely have more of an answer on that.
Do you mean like how much are players talking about it like on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, like, you know, how much does the subject of, like, Twitter or Instagram or whatever come up and, like, their particular usage of it, what they're seeing out there, how they're engaging with people, that sort of thing?
To be honest, I can't speak for every clubhouse. It kind of, on the teams that I've been a part of, it tends to vary with the guys on the team. I was on some teams in Oakland that had a number of guys that were pretty active on social media. And it was something that was talked about a lot more frequently, partially because like guys were like interacting with each other, on social media. And I think it's something that the fans really enjoyed. But like the team I'm like now the Nationals, there's a handful of guys that are on social media, but it's not as active. So, guys aren't talking about it as much. It's not something where guys come in and, you know, somebody, you know, kind of, you know, nudges you with their elbow and they say, hey, did you see what so-and-so tweeted? Or do you see, hey, did you hear about this? Look, this is trending or something like that. Like, so I think it's really, something that's more, a team to team basis.
MLB recently crafted a new DV policy. And while it's definitely a step in the right direction, it's in no way a cure-all for misogyny and harassment. Why do these issues persist? And is there internal pressure to further address these issues that those of us on the outside aren't seeing, especially how it can play into social media?
Yeah, I think we've seen this sort of recently. And, you know, without getting extremely specific here, in the case of social media, I think the players should maybe have a better understanding of the inequality in the power dynamic in every Twitter exchange or Instagram exchange or any of those social media exchanges that they may be getting into. You know, so if a player were to say, you know, say something or rally people to harass another social media user with, say, 100 followers or something, that's not an appropriate use of their platform, because what they're doing is they're fully aware that this, you know, that people will come to their defense and side with them over the other person. And that's the textbook definition of bullying. That's how bullying persists. That is how bullying proliferates. And I think that they should have a better understanding of how to use their platform responsibly so that there aren't any instances where fans are or followers are swarming and doxing and abusing and harassing people and really, you know, in service of, in their minds, the athlete that they're quote unquote defending or in service of their team loyalty or fan loyalty. I think that's really inappropriate. And I think that's harassment. I think they're all equally culpable.
I think on both subjects, the social media issue and the DV policy, I think we need to do as a sport a better job of being proactive in both these areas. I think the policies and some of the things that we have in place, it's all been very reactionary. I think we could do a better job with the education of both of these things. I think, like Aaron said, with the social media stuff, that's something that it does get talked about, usually in spring training. There might be a meeting about it. We have a lot of meetings in spring training, a lot of meetings. So you're there for 6 weeks. I would say several mornings a week, we have a meeting. And after the first handful, it kind of starts to become a little bit of a formality. You're not getting everybody's attention in every meeting. So sometimes these meetings that we have kind of just serve a purpose for Major League Baseball to kind of check off a box and say that they're doing this. But I think it's something that's super important. So I don't know the best way maybe to kind of raise these issues in a way that will connect more with players. But I think players having a healthy understanding of the best ways to interact with people or not to interact with people sometimes on social media. Also, regarding the domestic violence policy, not just continuing to educate players, but like what to do if what could another player do? Like if a teammate, if you suspect a teammate of doing something wrong, where do you go? Who do you reach out to? Because are you going to, and this also goes for the family members of players, because is a family member of a player going to feel comfortable reaching out to the employer of the husband or boyfriend who is doing the abusing in this case? That creates like a weird power dynamic. So increasing the ways that the issue can be raised confidentially and also by the victims of the abuse, I think could help to, maybe make the process a little bit, make the policy at least more effective.
Yeah, I think that to have a more effective policy, I think education doesn't end with the players. I think it has to extend out to the family members as well. That's wife, partner, girlfriend, fiance, children, anything like that. Because, you know, it's fantastic that they are educating the players on here are the resources, here's what is available, here's what the consequences are for domestic violence. Here is, you know, and a better, broader understanding of respect for, you know, within your family and not resorting to violence or abuse or anything like that. I think it's great that they have that, but what about the family members then that would in theory be the abused one? Where do they reach out? They don't have that sort of education in place. They don't have those meetings in spring training. We do have meetings in spring training for family members or spouses and partners. Most teams that we've been with have had that where it's mostly just like I get to know people where, you know, the team will say, here's where you would park. Here's where you can go and buy your tickets for the games. And here's where you go to pick up your tickets and all of that. But in my experience, since this DV policy, as it's been rehauled, is relatively new. I think it's a couple of years old. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that teams have sort of gotten much guidance on how to share that information with spouses and with the partners. And so what we have then is a situation in which, as Sean mentioned, in theory, if a person were being abused by a baseball player playing for Major League Baseball, that person would either have to go through their partner to to ask what the contact would be at Major League Baseball to get this rectified, or they would have to go circumvent the abuser and go to the abuser's employer. And, you know, what's the number to call? Who are you? Obviously, you can't make that contact public, but who do you give that number to?
These channels might exist, to be honest with you, and if we're to be fair, but I don't know of them, and I think that's kind of a problem.
That's the problem, yeah.
That they're not more well known. The issue hasn't been raised enough that I can't just remember who to reach out to off the top of my head. That the families might not know what to do to try to help someone else that's being affected by this. So I think that's kind of the issue is being more proactive about letting people know how this policy actually works.
Right. I think because otherwise we will continue to have what we've been having, which is MLB gets involved whenever there's a police report filed or somebody else reports them or somebody makes an accusation on social media, then they will step in and I suppose they will be the one to contact the person who is the victim, I suppose. But I think there's a way if they were to educate the families as well, that way the families would know if you suspect that this is happening, maybe even with one of your teammates' family members, here are some intervention strategies. Here are some effective ways that MLB is here to be the support network that you need, to provide you with resources and to help, you know, remove you from that situation.
Yeah, right. Just thinking about it, just like more bystander intervention protocols, especially like in a lot of other spaces, there's a lot of talk about adding more information on how not to just be a bystander but an upstander, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely, because I think in the case like this, even if this is of course all hypothetical, if I were to be sitting in the stands talking with another player's partner or spouse and suspect or have some sort of suspicion that there is physical or verbal or emotional abuse happening, I wouldn't necessarily know who to contact or if that's, I think it's human instinct, as we've seen in the past, which has had deadly consequences in the past, that we assume that somebody else is taking care of it. We assume that somebody else is stepping in. And so, you know, maybe we also think it's not our business. We don't want to hurt the other, you know, we don't want to get involved in somebody else's home life. And that's got to stop, because if you suspect that this is happening, that sort of thing doesn't go away, and it doesn't minimize it. It always escalates. And if we can have effective intervention strategies for bystanders, in this case, other family members of other players, or other players and their teammates, if they think it's happening, like I think that would go a long way, and we wouldn't have to have something that's only reactive. We would be able to maybe stop it before it gets really, really dangerous and possibly deadly.
Mm-hmm. Kind of along those lines, it seems like a big issue is that both writers and fans in general see issues, whether it be social or media harassment or claims of domestic violence or other forms of abuse, as something that is kind of outside of their realm in terms of caring about it and having the ability to act on it. So is there anything that we can do to kind of hold management and players accountable on these issues?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that have bothered me, you know, since as long as I can remember, in thinking about these public issues of domestic violence and abuse and that athletes are committing, is that the fan reaction has largely been their fan base related. I'm not sure quite how to say that, but a lot of it, the strongest reaction has been, it sort of centers the fan in a way, or the fan base in the experience as they see themselves as a part of it. And, you know, they want to instinctively defend their team's player if the player is, you know, great for their team, and they're more likely to minimize it or say, well, it's okay, there's no proof, or whatever it is that people say. And if the player is on their team and they're not very good, or maybe there's somebody who they wish, you know, they would call a bum or a scrub or whatever, they might be like, we got to get this guy off the team. But only then. It's always performance based. It's always through the lens of their team's performance and how much their team needs that person. And on the other hand, when you see these instances and your, you know, team's rival team player is accused of something like this, other fans might, they root it in, again, their fan experience. They're thinking in terms of being a fan first and not in terms of like, oh, these are people, this is an employee, and whether he's on a different team or not from the one that I like, he's done something that is inexcusable, and we need to do something. We need to respond to the actual victim, not the owners who may be losing out on the, you know, the money from the player who's suspended, or, you know, the wins that it costs the team because the player suspended. Like, forget all that. Like, we can't keep thinking of it like that. And it's really disheartening. And it's also like disruptive, and it distracts from the actual issue. So I think that's one of the biggest things that people need to remember, is that when you see an instance of domestic violence, whether it's with your favorite team or with your, you know, rival team, don't center yourself or your fan experience. Don't try to remove yourself from the fan viewpoint and think of it as how you would react if, say, somebody in the entertainment industry, like an actor or actress, were you know, experiencing this. I'm not sure how well I articulated that, but that's sort of my thought on that.
Yeah, I think you did a good job of articulating that.
I also think that it's important to hold players accountable and for them to be available to the media to demonstrate growth, because a lot of the victims in the past have reported, this is all self-reported, and that they were very hesitant to report or call the police or report their instances of abuse because they were worried that, well, this might mean my partner now will lose money, and that's what we rely on to keep our family supported. And I know that's a hard thing to conceptualize when a lot of these players are making millions of dollars. You know, it's like, well, they'll be fine, but it would be a lot more public, if nothing else, for these families. It might be publicly embarrassing in their mind. And so they're less likely to want to report it publicly. So I think that the answer is not always it's not necessarily remove the player, fired immediately, whatever. I think we need to be able to, and of course that's not in every case, I think you need to allow for the possibility of growth and change. And if that person is demonstrating a willingness to change, a commitment to it, an ongoing change. Change is not something that you hit at one point, like you've turned your life around and you're done. It's ongoing, and it's every single day. So one of the things that we can do to hold people accountable, continue to ask what they're doing to have, you know, change their behaviors and the way that they view relationships and, you know, their use of violence or harassment or emotional abuse or whatever the case may be. Of course, there are certain cases that are absolutely egregious and, you know, growth may not be possible. So I don't know if there's an easy answer, but I know that the answer is not what is currently in place.
Go ahead.
One small thing, because I agree wholeheartedly with everything that Aaron just said. I would like to echo her part about providing a space where they're held accountable but can also demonstrate growth. I think a lot of times in these, we see an issue that happens, a domestic violence issue that happens, and the statement that comes out from the player or the team always says something inevitably about how they, you know, look forward to becoming active in this space and using their experience and learning from it and trying to become, you know, like a voice for change and stuff like that. And we very rarely see that followed through on, at least publicly. I don't know if it's going on behind the scenes. Maybe that's not fair for me to speculate on all the time, because these are sensitive issues. I think one role the media might be able to play, fans might be able to play as well, is trying to follow up on that. Because I think that's over the long run, that's going to be the biggest driver of meaningful change on these topics. Because like what Aaron said, like as we've seen in the game, if a player is suspended for one of these incidents and he's released by the team, the unfortunate reality of the situation is that another team's going to pick the player up.
Yeah.
And they're going to get a massive discount on this player. This is the unfortunate.
It incentivizes
this
that.
This is the unfortunate business side of this. Another team is going to pick that guy up, and they're only going to have to pay the guy the league minimum salary, and the other team, his former team that released him, is going to be on the hook for the remainder of whatever they owed him. Mm-hmm. So I think putting together something that tries to hold the player accountable, hold the organization accountable, while allowing for growth and change, is the best way to go about it.
Right. And when you say, actually, I do want to touch on something you said, Sean, when you said, we don't know what a lot of these players who have been, you know, accused in the past or have, you know, done something abusive on social media or something like that, we don't know what their follow through is. We don't know what they're doing after behind the scenes. They may be doing something behind the scenes, but I think, Sean, don't you think that if somebody is in that situation, they should absolutely be doing these things publicly. It's great if they are doing things at all, period, but why wouldn't you do it publicly? Don't you think that they have a responsibility to do those sorts of things publicly? Because the thing that they've done was of a public nature, yeah, in the sense that it became public story and there was a public response that, well, there was a response from the team or the league that asked the fan base, the public, to sign on board with it, basically, and be like, well, you know, this team's going to sign him. Are you guys okay? Are you fans okay with that? So it does elicit a public response. It does demand a public response. Am I still going to be a fan of this team? Am I not? Is this my breaking point? So I think you do have a responsibility to do this sort of follow through, whether, you know, you've been, you know, charged with domestic violence, you know, and you say you're going to follow through by donating to these places, and you're going to visit, you know, you're going to volunteer at different, you know, places where that would demonstrate growth in a public way. You should be doing that publicly, because that's showing the growth that if fans are expected to sign on to or endorse or even tacitly endorse, you know, your continuing existence in the league, you should be, you know, reciprocating that by showing, like, this is the person I am, this is the growth that I'm committed to, you know, continuing to do. And, you know, it also, I think actually, Jen, you made this point earlier this summer where the response from a lot of players was something like, I'm sorry again to harp on this and for so long, but the response from some of those players when there were the social media accounts, the case of the old tweets being,
yeah,
sort of, how do people respond to that sort of thing? I think you brought up a really important point that the answer can no longer be the player saying, I'm sorry, I've hurt my team. I've hurt my teammates. I've embarrassed my team, the organization. The thing that you've done, I think, as you said, the problem wasn't that you were a bad employee. The problem was that you did something that, you know, that was harmful, that would be harmful for anybody else to commit in the public, you know, for quote unquote civilians to do. And the problem wasn't that you've hurt your organization. It's not in economic terms. It's not, you didn't commit a crime against your teammates or your organization. You did it against a different person. You know, I'm sorry I hurt my family. I'm sorry I let, you know, fans down and the public down, and I did something that set such a terrible example that, you know, I don't like in myself. I think there's a better way to frame that, and that's that hurting your team or organization is certainly not the answer.
Yeah, I was just thinking of, like, you know, how all these players had all their tweets dug up over the summer, and how, like, their apology was always directed towards their team or their teammates and letting them down. But it's like, well, you also let the fans down, and, like, a lot of the homophobic slurs, especially with the LGBTQ population, kind of, like, there's a huge LGBTQ fan population in baseball, and it alienates them, but there's no apology to them.
Yeah, there's all of these groups that are marginalized are also a huge contingent of the fan base. And that's not, of course, to say that they should be thought of as, in economic terms, as, like, you know, a market to be exploited or, you know, rejected or whatever the case may be. But to frame it as, like, well, his teammates are fine with it, which was another thing, was some of these players, when they did things like this, other, you know, members of the media were asking their teammates who may have been marginalized people of color, or people who had, you know, somebody who was disabled in their family or somebody who was LGBTQ in their family. Well, they would be asking them, are you offended? Do you forgive this person? Do you forgive your teammate? And it's like, well, they didn't do it against their teammate. These are fans. These are people. And this is a public thing now. And it doesn't begin and end. The final arbiters of whether or not this person has changed or should be forgiven are not, you know, the teammates. They are a part of it, but they're not the final say on whether this person has demonstrated growth or change or is contrite. So, you know, I can't tell you how often I think back on that, you know, what you had said earlier this summer about that when all those old tweets had resurfaced. And I think that's a really great point.
Well, let's kind of move on to a more positive aspect of some of these issues that we raised in the discussion about social media. Since you've been in DC, you've done great advocacy work for Smile, which is a local LGBTQ youth assistance program. Most recently, you exchanged autographed memorabilia for donations. So how much did you raise in your most recent campaign, and are there any kind of weird pieces of memorabilia that donors are going to be receiving?
All memorabilia we have is weird. But yeah, we don't actually have the final numbers because the way that we had framed it structured it, I don't think we were able to see ultimately how many people, you know, were engaged with it and donated maybe anonymously, or because they didn't donate through us or a GoFundMe that strictly we had set up and we would be filtering through it. It was through Smile, who I'm on the board at Smile, which is a wonderful organization for LGBTQ young people in DC metro area. But I think the preliminary numbers within a couple of hours, they believed it was about $6,000, which
that's $12,000.
It did get to 12,000 that day. $12,000 were raised. Now we can't say if all $12,000 was strictly our, you know, promoting that and promising, you know, thank you notes and memorabilia. But we were like, we were so thrilled to demonstrate that fans of baseball are extremely generous, think of themselves as a community who cares about the less fortunate in their community, the marginalized in their community. And we were extremely thankful that they were so generous, because I know times are really, really tough for so many people. And that's something that Sean and I constantly worry about forgetting, you know, and we have to be mindful of, because I think if I were a fan who maybe of a team and, you know, with ticket prices going up and the holidays had just happened, I may be less inclined to donate to a nonprofit. I know that's kind of a hard ask at the end of the year, especially around the holidays. So we do want to be mindful that giving of in any capacity is extremely, extremely helpful, and it goes a long way with Smile. So as far as the weirdest things that we've found, I mean, in our weird baseball closet of mystery, which is basically, so I want to explain what that is. We have a couple of storage units and closets, which are full of, I think, misfit toys, or what do you want to call it? I think we have all the remaining
stuff that I accumulated in my locker over the years.
The, like, black hole of your locker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's several boxes of bobbleheads and,
Not just the recent Nationals bobblehead either. You have some Oakland A's ones where they play like the Metallica, your old walk-up song.
Yeah.
We have dog bowls that are that has one of our dog's faces on them that the Oakland A's had given out. So we were thinking about how we could get the dog to sign those and send those out. I think we actually have the remaining misspelled Stockton Ports Sean Doolittle bobbleheads.
Those are somewhere. Yep.
That I can't believe there were any remaining, because they still gave them out even though it was spelled wrong.
I was actually there that series when they gave it out.
Did you get one?
I did.
Oh, can Sean sign it misspelled?
I would be glad
to. My favorite part about that is that you would think they would misspell my last name with just one O, right? Like D-O-L-I-T-T-L-E, because that's like, you know, the movie people are more familiar with probably anyway. Mm-hmm. But no, they forgot the L at the end, so it was D-O-L-I-T-T-E.
How weird.
I think it'd be Latte, because like...
That was such a minor name giveaway. And the fact that they knew it and still gave it away is one of my favorite things that I just... Every time we've gone back to Stockton, when you've had rehab games or rehab starts or something with the A's, I just love that experience. The fan experience there. Is it still called Banner Island?
It still is Banner Island. I'm there like 20 times a season still.
Oh, I love it.
I do just want to say too that Aaron's favorite part of the whole season is the day that I unpack my locker and bring everything home.
Oh, the day after the
partially because it means it's the end and we'll get to spend a lot more time together, but also because she goes through the boxes that I bring home and puts everything on.
I try everything once,
at once. Yeah. So she's wearing we have some really great pictures.
Batting helmets that don't fit anyone's head.
We have some really great pictures of Erin wearing everything that she could put on her body that came out of my locker. And I'm holding them over her head as some sort of...
somewhere that'll be leverage, but I actually... Yeah,
some sort of leverage.
You can't shame me if I have shame, all right? Like, I will put that anywhere. Like, it's the most fun day. It's when you walk in the house and you have that giant, oversized team logo bag, it's my favorite day. It's my Christmas. Like, I get all of your old stupid baseball bracelet, baseball jewelry, fakey, whatever.
So the fact that Aaron was willing to part with some of these things in order to raise money for Smile tells you, I think, how important it is to us. And,
yes.
And we're super glad that people were so generous and were so willing to help.
Yeah.
How did you find out about Smile, and what about it led to your decision to support them?
Oh, we found out about Smile, actually, Sean. I think it was early on, right after you were traded to the Nationals. And I do want to say the Nationals have been an extremely generous organization in supporting everything we pitch to them. Everything that we say if we come up with a group, a nonprofit, or, you know, a lobbying group, or some sort of community advocacy, the Nationals are like right on board asking, how can we help? They have a whole team in place that can help support us in giving back, not to use that sort of cliched word. So the Nationals, as soon as Sean had been traded there about a year and a half ago, they approached us and said, look, I know that our Pride game has already happened from this year, but we want to step it up. We have the longest running, the longest standing Pride, I think it's annual Pride game streak of any team in baseball. I think they have had the game for the longest, which was really impressive. It's hugely attended. Everybody has like a really great time, and it is just, it's super fun. But they came to us and said, how do we make this more about community and less about, I think some teams' tendency is to make it about kind of marketing and branding, and it's a cheap way to make a buck. Sometimes they just see it as an opportunity to sell tickets, and they don't think of it as a way to give back to the community that is already there as fans every other game. So when the Nationals said, we want to make this a community thing, and they brought up Smile to us, we immediately went and visited with their board, and we visited their community center in Southeast DC, which is where we live. And we knew right away that this was a resource that was absolutely critical in DC and in DC's metro area and rural areas around it. It's an after-school program. It's a community center. It's a leadership program. It's it has leadership camps. It's safe sex education programs. It's health programs. And even now it's a program that they've just started a transitional housing program for at-risk LGBTQ teens who are experiencing housing insecurity and homelessness. And they're expanding it now. And in this past year, which it's really impressive to see the work that they do, the foothold they have in the community, and the way that they are looking to grow, to involve families, allies, educating support networks of adults who are, they may not have a family member or something. Maybe these are teachers or people in professions who are coming in contact with LGBTQ young people, and they want to know the best practices in supporting them. And Smile is able to do all of these things. They are able to provide so much, and it's so much more than just a community center that we knew that that was our go-to in DC. And that's why I joined the board. I have not looked back. I'm really thrilled to work with them. And yeah, we just really love Smile.
They sound like an incredible organization, especially with the transitional housing. Just to kind of give you background of like what I do for my day job, I work as a nonprofit program coordinator. And I'm actually part of the leadership team for the Homeless Youth Count. And I know that like a lot of housing is very scarce in California. And a lot of the youth who are on the streets are LGBTQ youths who might have like run away from families who might not be accepting of them, or they don't have any other resources. So to hear that Smile provides that housing in the DC area is incredible.
Yeah. I think that Sean was telling me earlier that I think it was, what was it, 42%?
I think it's 43% of the homeless youth in D.C. Identify as LGBTQ. And so the fact that Smile is getting really involved in the space is really good to see. It's something that's really needed, especially in a city like D.C. As great as it is, we love D.C., but you're seeing so much gentrification throughout the whole city that there is a housing crisis. Rents are skyrocketing. It's super expensive to live in the city now as mm-hmm. they go through almost neighborhood by neighborhood and, you know, gentrify it, put up bigger, more expensive apartments and stuff like that. And unfortunately, there is a need for housing, but
particularly LGBTQ teens.
Right, which who is are the where, most vulnerable.
Yeah, exactly. They're the most vulnerable in D.C. and around D.C. And Smile is, we were able to visit actually the transitional housing program building over the summer and meet some of the residents, which that was an incredible experience to see how far they had come in so short of, like, an amount of time. Just, you know, because of that resource of having a place to live and not having to worry about that anymore, not having to worry about housing insecurity, what that has enabled them to do and to, you know, not just survive anymore, but really thrive. And it was so impressive to meet these people.
And
they were Nats fans too, which like, that's another example. Like, I don't think they were just saying that. They knew their stuff. Like, they weren't just saying that because Sean was there and we were visiting sort of on an off day. It was like, they knew their stuff. They knew, you know, everything, and they were really engaged as fans. And that just goes to show, like, this is a fan base that needs to be engaged and better taken care of. And, you know, I think it's wonderful how Smile has been able to team with the Pride Nights and stuff.
Yeah, it sounds like they're doing really good and important work. And it's also great that it was the Nationals that got you in touch with them in the first place. But is there anything specific about being involved in MLB and with baseball that you find lends itself to charity work?
I mean,
you have the platform and resources.
Yeah, you kind of have the built-in platform and resources. A lot of times, just the team that you play for, the organization that you're with, might have a little bit. They might have already like pre-existing inroads into places in your community where you can get involved. I mean, your name carries a little bit more clout, so that if you reach out to an organization, you're more likely to get a response back. I don't know. Like it's as a player, if you want to get involved, the organizations will help you make the right connections. So it's been easy for us to try to maximize our impact.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what would you say is kind of the biggest area of improvement when it comes to fan and team involvement with these kinds of organizations?
I think, going back to what we were talking about with the Pride games or the LGBTQ nights out at ballparks and those sorts of themed games, I think it's important that teams improve how they engage with this community and how they think of them as fans, not as a niche market, not as some supplement, but these are, supplementary fan base that they have the option to engage. Like, these are fans that are already there. Think of them as such. And don't just think about it as branding. Don't just think about how many corporate sponsors that you can get, think about how you can use it as an opportunity to get involved in that space, that community space, and see how your team can serve that community, because they're fans. They're right. Already there.
And I think the more the teams can put, I don't know how to best phrase this. I want to say almost humanize, or make an effort to more connect by either making it more about just one night at the ballpark. That was one thing. With Night Out, we told the organization, look, I want to do more than catch the first pitch. We're going to make some visits, to Smile, in advance of Pride Night to promote it. On the night itself, is there anything else that we could do to make it a special experience? The Nationals were absolutely outstanding. They hosted a party before the game.
Pre-party
for the game. That was right. I think it was 2 days after the Supreme Court case with the baker in Colorado, and we told the Nationals we wanted to get cakes for the party, and they set it all up and helped us get that done. And yeah, I thought that was really cool that they were willing to help us do that. And we had people down on the field before the game as well. So I think for these nights that they do at the parks, that's kind of a really good example. I think the Nationals did an incredible job, and I'm so grateful for all their help and support. And but finding ways to make those connections with fans a little bit more than maybe having someone from that whatever community it is throw out the first pitch, or you put their picture on the Jumbotron. Do you have any players that might connect with this on some level that want to get involved? And stuff like that to kind of really make it a little bit more special.
Yeah, it's certainly more of a holistic experience when all of the aspects of, from the pregame, during the game, player engagement, all of that, and you're using some of the money to, donate to some of these groups. I think it just creates a much better experience that's more sustainable and longer lasting and is bigger than just kind of marketing opportunity.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, and it's really, really great that the Nationals are so receptive to all of that.
Yeah, they did. I mean, that's just as Sean said with the cake, from the smallest details, like making sure that they had drinks and cake, and from those details all the way up to facilitating, you know, doing all the heavy lifting as far as connecting us with these groups, making sure that we were at these organizations and making sure that we talked to the right people and were able to best leverage that opportunity. They did like way more than I think most other teams think that they should have to. And it goes to show that that's the success you have is directly proportionate to how much you are willing to put invest in community involvement as a team. You may think it's not necessary, but you know, it really is, and it's fruitful for everybody involved.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at @JenMacRamos. You can find Sarah at @SarahWexler32. You can find Mary at @MaryMCraig. You can find Aaron at @AaronDolan. You can find Sean at @WhatWouldDewDo. You can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times audio on iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for the conclusion of this episode.